Today on Backroom Today on Backroom Politics, everyone back in the pool. The Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader cancel summer vacation, at least for July. That ticking sound you hear from the Capitol, that's the time clock on the debt ceiling quickly running out. There could be a new opening in the Orange County, Florida DA's office after the Casey Anthony gets off for murder. Congressman Al, myself, Bob Hines, and a special guest, John Freshman, today on Backroom Politics. It's getting off to a good start already. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Tuesday, July 5th, 2011, 4 o'clock in the Eastern Standard or Eastern Daylight Time. It's Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is America's premier political roundtable broadcasting from America's premier cigar lounge in the heart of Washington, D.C. Joining me as they are every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
How was your fourth?
It was fantastic. I actually saw the fireworks, spent 20 minutes watching fireworks, watching stuff explode over Washington, D.C., and another 2 hours getting home. It was fantastic. To my right, out of his normal chair, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here, and it's the only place to be.
Absolutely.
On a Tuesday at 4 o'clock.
I would also say this is the only time you've been introduced correctly.
No, that's not true. Now, I've been getting it right the past few weeks.
He's getting closer.
Yeah. I'm getting closer.
You are close.
You see, you're not doing well for me in front of our new guest here today. Joining us in the studio today, he is a former official at EPA. Former Senate
Special Staff on the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee.
That's the one I was looking for. Joining us today is our special guest, John Freshman. John, thanks for joining us here at Backroom Politics.
Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. It is time for me to give out the call-in number for those of you out in Radio Land who'd like to join in. Our phone number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. As it is every week, lots of stuff going on, but it's deja vu all over again. We're going to talk a lot today about the fiscal crisis, but I want to touch on breaking news coming out of Orlando, Florida, the Casey Anthony trial, which has been running pretty much the first hour of today's show and any other headline news show you watch. Casey Anthony has been found not guilty of first-degree murder in the death of her daughter. Her young daughter down there in Orlando, Florida. I got to tell you something. That is just striking. I mean, I was talking earlier to a couple of friends of mine here in Shelley's. It is a testament to our legal system. You know, this happens once every few years. You have the OJ trial once in a while. Bob, you're an attorney. You've been around the legal system a long time. Is there anything that kind of strikes you? I know you haven't been following this religiously, but what strikes you about this latest verdict coming out of Orange County?
Well, they had no direct evidence, no DNA, no confession, and they had a lot of circumstantial evidence, and the jury just didn't believe it was enough.
It goes back to the whole idea of, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, and obviously the DA's office in Orange County, Florida, there's going to be a few job openings, I would say, down there.
Yeah, I think so. They'll probably retire early on half pay.
Yeah, they have a program in Florida called the Drop Program. It's kind of really, really early retirement. That's looking real attractive right now. When you look at Casey Anthony, again, this happens every 5 years. You have something that says, you know, everybody knew OJ did it, but a jury of his peers found him not guilty. Everybody knew, at least in our minds, that Casey Anthony did it. And the reality is that in a jury of her peers, they cannot prove without a shadow of reasonable doubt that she did do it. I mean, if we have to go through this every 5 years and we're getting this thing knocked out once every, you know, we're getting 95% record, we're not sending a majority of innocent people to jail, that's a pretty good testament to our judicial program. John?
I haven't been following it that closely.
Okay. Join us for the peanut gallery. Frank, what do you got?
As a former law enforcement officer from Florida, it's been my contention that if you cannot confuse them with the truth, bamboozle them with BS. They did the defense did a marvelous job of pointing the blame away from their client, which in our society, if they can't, beyond a reasonable doubt. So they should have gone for a lesser included offense of negligent homicide for manslaughter. They should have gotten that list of possibles down a little bit more, where the burden of proof is less for the defense to push aside. She got away with one this time. I mean, my theory is she was the last person to see her alive, and her habitual liar. So, I mean, where does this go from here?
Well, a jury of her peers have found her guilty of lying to a law enforcement officer. That's the most serious
exactly.
of the charges.
Right.
So she'll probably do a couple of years for that, if any, for those charges. But a truly, truly amazing jury verdict coming out of Orange County, Florida. But that's, you can watch TMZ for that. Let's get to the heart of what Blackroom Politics is all about, the business of government in Washington. The other big story coming out of Washington right now is that ticking time clock coming out of the Capitol and the current fiscal crisis. We talked last week about there being the possibility of a deal being brokered. That deal being brokered has yet to be announced. Everybody's keeping hush about a possible deal, but apparently something's working. Now, the president has come out and said that we've got until, Treasury Secretary Geithner came out and says we got until July 22nd to get something locked down in place. Bob, you think that's possible?
Well, of course it's possible, but the question is likely. I don't know if it's likely or not, but I do know this. There's an awful lot of back talk, you know, back room talk going on, and they don't have much time, and I don't think anybody likes the idea of not having a settlement.
Well,
except the Tea Party people.
John, go ahead.
Well, I think that there's a very subtle shift that's going on if you sort of look past the rhetoric of we can't raise taxes, we can't do anything with entitlements, and try to figure out what's really happening. And the shift began with Tom Coburn, who's one of the smartest people up there. What's happening is they're realizing that tax credits and eliminating tax credits are not raising taxes. What they're doing is they're cutting spending. And all of a sudden you get guys like Senator Cornyn, guys like Senator Coburn start talking about that. That to me is a big shift, because you need to have some revenue somewhere in the pot to make the deal work.
Well, you know, and Al, when we talked about this in great extent last week, you know, at what point do we start looking at making deals that are painful to all sides? One of the deals that was on the table I heard was they were talking about a millionaire tax. Anybody above $1 million going into a whole new tax bracket to create revenue, but yet the Republicans on the other side of the aisle saying, hey, you're taxing the people that are going to reinvest into creating jobs.
That's a Republican argument, and like so many things that have been around forever, there's some truth to it, and there's sometimes it's greatly overused and exaggerated. The idea is that you've got to give the money to the rich so that they can invest it in plants, which create jobs, and it all trickles down. The trickle-down theory is not new at all. But there's an element of truth in it. You know, if you break every millionaire in the country, you certainly will bring commerce to a halt. But that's not what the Democrats are talking about at the present time. I have a hope. I hope that what's going on with the vice president, what have you, is getting more done than they're talking about. Because if they've been making progress there, they can perhaps put it together very fast, surprisingly fast. If in fact they haven't been asking these tough questions among themselves, then I don't see how they get it done.
But almost seems like, Bob, that there's been a lot, you know, we've been going through this large kabuki dance of politics here in Washington until the absolute last minute. This is been a complete demonstration of political procrastination beyond all recognition. When we look at this, do you think that the hard, painful decisions can be made in time, or are they going to come up with another Band-Aid solution, hoping to carry over into another budget cycle?
There's no doubt they can make the hard decisions. This hasn't been so much procrastination as it is a brinkmanship. And it strikes me that the real question, I think the Senate is an easier sell on a deal that has cuts in spending and tax expenditure reductions.
And even with Harry Reid?
Yeah, I do. And I think this, the real issue is going to be in the House of Representatives. And it's not just going to be, will the Tea Party vote? It's going to be, will some of the liberals vote? If the moderate Democrats and the moderate Republicans can come together and get enough numbers to pass in the House, I think the Senate can pass it.
But what we're dealing with on the Republican side, we still have a very antagonistic, for lack of a better term, Tea Party caucus inside the House that's going to cause a lot of hate and discontent within the voting.
And you've got Wilbur Norquist, who has got everybody, almost all the Republicans.
And that's the record. We brought up Wilbur Norquist only within the first 5 minutes. That's impressive. Nice job, Al.
But what they signed said, don't increase taxes and don't do away with tax expenditures.
Exactly.
So what we're saying here is they're going to have to tell Wilbur Norquist, at least partially, to go to hell. They're going to be troubled doing that. There's not been a demonstration, in my judgment, on either party's part of a great courage. And taking on Grover Norquist, if you're a conservative, is a dangerous thing to do.
Almost any Republican, as you say, I would say 95% of the Republicans in Congress have signed that pledge in both House and Senate, so it's going to be very difficult, but I think that they're going to have to do it.
I also think this is a big test for the Republican Party as they try to figure out, in the context of 85 new members, who they are. I mean, I think that there are many splinters and many caucuses in the House of Representatives, and I don't think we know who they are. I don't think we know how they're going to vote, and whether or not they're going to just pursue brinksmanship or govern is what we're going to find out in the next 17 days.
All right, but John, here's the question that comes up on that. When we look at the 85 new members that could be in play on this, you know, trying to guess at this late stage who's going to be the more moderate of that 85, which has decidedly come in on a tidal wave of Tea Party, is going to be a difficult, difficult play, especially if you're on the minority side and in the White House trying to strike a deal for this. This doesn't bode well for Speaker Boehner, at least, trying to keep everybody in line? Or am I making too much out of this?
I don't think you're making too much out of it at all. I think that there's a lot of pressure on the House leadership right now to try to pull something together. I think that Bob's right, the Senate will do, I mean, basically what it needs to do, but whether something can pass the House or not, you know, I mean, you got people saying that, look, you know, the default doesn't really matter. You could just pay the interest on the bills. Well, I'm not an economist, but I know those people that are saying it aren't economists either.
Right.
I mean, you know, the debt ceiling does matter. And so it's a big test right here, right now.
Well, look, you know, remind yourself, fellas, that early in the session, Boehner arranged to make sure, the Speaker made sure that the Tea Party gang in the House, and I shouldn't say gang, but the group of Tea Party guys and gals in the House, who wanted to be able to vote on certain positions, he made sure they had an opportunity to vote on those positions. And they did, and the Senate rejected them. Now, I think there were at least three votes like that. They're all on financial matters that they were able to get their votes on. Now, this ought to help a little bit, and I say a little bit, it'll help a lot with some and a little bit with others. Some of them will be able to say, look, I did everything I could to get what you wanted. I voted for the principles that you and I talked about during the campaign last year. We didn't have enough. The answer is not blow up the government and go and have a deficit disaster. The deal here we got to get is we got to get more people like us in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, but here's the thing about this, Bob, is every time we go through this evolution, and we've been talking about this particular subject, it's deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
We've been now talking about the subject for now 4 months. The reality still dictates is every time we get to a critical point, whether it's government shutdown or we're coming up against the debt ceiling, everybody wants to go back to the table and start anew, and yet nobody, nobody that I've heard inside of any of the leadership on both sides of the aisle or coming out of the White House still says we still have Simpson Bowles to deal with and contend with, which was a solid plan. You still have the Paul Ryan budget plan, which was a solid blueprint for a budget deal.
Yeah, Alice Riblin.
The Riblin
and
one?
Peterson.
Peterson deal. There are numerous places, but we keep going back to the drawing board, and nothing gets done. Why are we still trying to reinvent the wheel?
Because the Republicans have a hard time figuring out when they've won. They have won the debate over expenditures. You know, we have reversed the growth. Expenditures are started. Every one of the appropriations bills, which are on a separate track, all they change the number, all of them, have a significant, start with like food safety and the agriculture appropriations bill, have significant reduction of expenditures in them. And there's $2 trillion to $3 trillion worth of cuts in everybody's discussion about what the Biden group is talking about. The cuts are there.
They've got to say we won. Yeah, but here's the thing is, they're not still, according to all the sources coming out of both sides, not to the level that are satisfactory that could get it through a House floor vote. Go ahead.
Well, it's easy to say the Republicans have won because there are cuts going on. But the other half of the Republicans' equation is no taxes. And they've never said, you know, no taxes means no taxes. Now, Gore Norquist says no tax increases means you get rid of the tax expenditures, which is, I think, a rather long reach. And there's a lot of things that can be done. We've talked about them at least every week for the last month, about all the possibilities there are in tax expenditures. And there's a lot more money at play in that area than taxing the people who are driving around in corporate airplanes.
Let me ask you, Al, does Grover Norquist's solution, or does he offer part of the solution to what could possibly be a deal, or is he too far to the other side that's going to get the Republicans a little bit up in arms?
If I understand his position correctly, it's not very complicated, he is not going to be a help. He's going to be a hindrance, and he is going to scare a lot of Republicans and maybe a few conservative Democrats. Here's the thing that I don't understand. These guys are afraid to go home and having raised taxes. Have they ever given any thought to what going home without doing anything will be? I think you could have an incredible rebellion, back to a throw the ball out, an anti-incumbent. You guys haven't been able to do anything. We'll get rid of all of you. Back to one of those kind of things.
I mean, do we go back to a clean... I mean, could we see a Republican White House, a Democratic House, and a Republican Senate?
Well,
I have no idea how that would play out, but anything is possible.
Well,
you could see a Democratic House. We're at a time of incredible volatility. This thing has been going back and forth and back and forth. We never had shifts like that when Al was a congressman. Yeah, you could.
Yeah, but
the other thing, I got just one question for you guys, because I have a bad memory. You know,
right.
I can't always get these things. Just trying to remember, I know Grover Norquist has had a series of responsible public. I know he's been elected by large groups of people, and he's been in close elections many times. He's had to put his ideas in front of the public. I just can't remember what they are. So if I could think of it, you know, I could be able to tell you that Grover was elected to. Grover's faced the voters. Grover's had to take responsibility. He just talks.
But Grover Norquist seems to be the voice coming out of the hill saying, this is what we got to do.
It should make people wonder.
Well,
it means an awful lot.
Tom Coburn is respected. He's worth listening to.
Yeah.
He's been elected. I listen to Tom Coburn. He's faced the people.
Interesting take.
When you sign on to some loyalty oath, kind of thing like the Grover Norquist thing is on taxes or on some other things, and once in a while the Democrats get trapped into this too, you're really giving up your authority as a congressman to be able to make your decision on the facts. You just have said, I'm going to be a Grover Norquist puppet, and I would like to run against some Republicans with that as my theme, right?
So, okay, We've got to come up on the break real quick. Hold that thought real quick. We're 20 after. Let's go to the break. When we come back, I'm going to lead off with you, Bob. I'm going to find out. I also want to ask the question is, you know, where does Grover Norquist get his clout? You know, this is a great question. He was elected too. He faced the voters and was held accountable.
Nowhere.
Where does Grover Norquist get his clout from? That's my big question.
Same place as Glenn.
Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck.
Okay. Well, we'll leave that alone. We'll leave that alone. So when we come back, you see, look, another Democrat's at the table. Yay!
Yeah.
So here we go. We're going to take a break. We will be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington D.C. Stay with us. And we're back at Shelley's Back Room in downtown Washington, D.C., 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics. Joining us as they always do. All of a sudden, Al just goes off on a tangent. Joining us, Congressman Al, our special guest, John Freshman, Bob Hines sitting at Ralph Winnie's table. We're going to go back and talk about the fiscal crisis and just the total political anarchy that's happening up on Capitol Hill right now. Bob, before the break, you had a point you wanted to make.
Well, I wanted to follow up on something that Al had said, and then we all talked about during the break. Talking about a member of Congress who has to go back home, and how does, you know, he has to justify, if he signed the pledge, he has to justify the pledge of Grover Norquist, no, not to raise taxes. But on the other hand, if he also has to say, oh, by the way, your Social Security check won't come in, or the Pell Grants are off this year, so your son won't be able to go to school, or the food stamp program are being cut, or schools...
Well, we don't have any money for firefighters.
Police. I mean, the fact of the matter is, this is a situation. This is a situation where we're going to have some significant cuts in expenditures, and there are going to be consequences from that. You're going to have some increases in revenues because you've got to be able to pay the bills.
I understand that. But, you know, when we talk about cuts, we talk about having to make the painful decisions. Look, there's going to have to be Republicans, and Al, agree with me or disagree with me, there are going to have to be Republicans who are going to have to make some key decisions. Look, we have to find a new revenue stream to come into this budget crisis.
I believe that is true, and I think that what both John and what Bob has been saying for weeks is go after those tax expenditures is the way to do that. And give the Tea Party people, if they choose to accept it, a little wiggle room.
But the tax expenditures, I mean, are the tax expenditures, and I'm literally going to come out sounding like a Democrat right now, are the tax expenditures the only solution? Do we have to find a new revenue stream other than the tax expenditures?
Oh, yeah, we've got to reform the tax code. We have to do it, but we can't do that in the context of this kind of brinksmanship. We have to reform the tax code.
Well, we can't do the tax code. My argument has always been that we can't fix it down. Excuse me, for those of you on the air, not on my A game today, fighting a little bit of a cold here. My argument has always been that we cannot fix the tax code with the segmented House that we have right now. You're going to have just a fight in the Republican Party with the Tea Party and the traditional GOP caucus. On top of the fact, you're still going to have to try and fix tax code. That's going to make a minority in the House happy. Bob.
Leadership and the Ways and Means Committee on both sides of the aisle have been working for about 6 months on this, quietly and behind the scenes. And they're going to keep on working.
But
Bob's right. Dave Camp is a serious player. It's so interesting. Michigan now has the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee,
right.
And one other one. Poor downtrodden Michigan has never been in better shape than it is.
It's a renaissance.
Our service is in the Senate.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Services, and there's one more. It'll jump in my head in a minute.
They got ranking member on Homeland Security in the House.
Dave Camp is a serious behind-the-scenes player who believes in the things that we're talking about with respect to tax reform.
But he
believes the same thing that I do. Different party. I believe the same thing about taxes as Dave Camp.
But which is admirable. Which is completely admirable. But I still contend a reform of the tax code until we can get Speaker Boehner or we can get Rince Priebus to get people in line in the House is going to be utterly an impossible evolution to go through.
They said the same thing in 1986 when they redid the entire tax code. They just did
we didn't have the splintered factions, the defined splintered factions, that we do today that we had in 86.
It's tougher today, I grant you that.
Literally, Al, if you were seated in Congress today, this has got to be an opportunity for the Democrats to really pounce and saying, look, we've got to do a reality check here.
Absolutely, and I frankly don't understand why the Democrats have been such pushovers. The president's press conference, or the speech that he gave a few days ago, was the first time that he really came out and made the Democrats' case in a very tough and direct way. If you don't tell people what you think you should be done, you can't blame them if they go with the guy who says, I got a solution. And the Democrats have not done a very good job of that. Maybe they will start now.
Well, that's the first time the president really did something we've been talking about for some time, which was, you know, get in front of the public and say, we got a problem and we have to solve it.
You really think that this is the first time he's actually shown the type of leadership that we've been calling for the past 6 months?
Well, you know,
I
may be a little bit harsh, but I think yes. I think I'm about where Al is. I think yes.
Really?
Yeah, he's finally saying, look, we got a deadline, goddammit. We have to solve the problem.
Okay.
Yeah, and he's been talking to people. He's playing golf with people. I mean, he's doing things with the leadership that he has to do. He's talking with them in times we don't know.
Okay, so Al, let's ask the question, is where was he up until now?
I don't understand his style. He did the same thing on
healthcare.
And I think he has a style, and maybe it's even a thought-out philosophy of how you lead from the rear. I don't know. I don't think it's working.
Right.
And apparently he's prepared to change that style a bit, given the speech the other day. And I think the change needs to take place.
Well, it's come late, but it's welcome.
But all right, let me play devil's advocate in this. And John, I'll throw this to you. When you see him coming out of the box saying, oh, all right, you know what, I am the leader, I am the president, I am the bully pulpit, and we're coming up on the deadline, something he should have done 6 months ago, does he have the credibility to truly stand up, pump his chest, saying, all right, let's get serious down to business?
He has the power to persuade. That's all the president has, if you remember Richard Neustadt. And yeah, he has the power to persuade. He's effective. He's articulate. And if he steps up big, he's still going to be the most important guy in the conversation.
But is it too little, too late out?
No, I don't think so. That's inside the Beltway thinking. And there's an awful lot of inside the Beltway thinking going on here, and which leaves the public wondering what on earth are those clowns doing. And the public needs to have an explanation, a clearer explanation than they've got already on how serious the budget situation is. And you need some people that will stand up and discuss that.
Well, you know, the amazing thing about it is that we found with this administration, we brought it up numerous times. And again, all due respect to the Office of the President and the staff of the White House, you have great message makers like David Axelrod, David Plouffe. You've got all kinds of people in play that can help him get a message. But this is the one administration that I've seen in recent memory that can't get a message out to save their life.
But he hasn't wanted to do it. That's the problem. Now he seems to realize he has to do it.
And he doesn't have a strong spokesman on financial or tax issues. He never,
You don't think? Well, I would venture to say we had this argument last week, John. You've got somebody with the experience that Joe Biden has in working in the Senate, working deals. To me, I think he's got a tremendous amount of credibility and should be the surrogate for the president in these discussions.
But Joe Biden's got to go to Afghanistan. He's got to show up at fires. He's got a lot of other through. This is supposed to be the Secretary of the Treasury.
So
we're supposed to be the leader.
Timothy Geithner, you don't think Timothy Geithner's got enough credibility to lead this?
He worked in the Federal Reserve Bank of the previous administration. You know, you need a strong Democrat leader, a Bill Daley for taxpayers and economists.
But remember, Geithner's the one
credibility.
Geithner gave us TARP. Geithner gave us auto bailout.
Cash for clunkers.
Cash for clunkers. Geithner's been behind a lot of the major financial programs. He's the architect of the stimulus bill for all intents and purposes. Yet, why is he not the right surrogate to be in front?
Well, John just said that the president doesn't have a strong spokesman in this area. And you're asking, well, why isn't he a strong spokesman? I don't know. Maybe it's in his DNA. I don't know.
See, I find Geithner to be a great spokesman. He's got credibility with Wall Street. Well, he's got credibility with the financial markets. He's got credibility with big business.
He hasn't got any credibility with the public.
Where's big business on this debt ceiling? How come they're not out here saying there are real consequences? Why don't we have press conferences on Wall Street with these guys saying you can't mess around with this? It's really serious, guys.
That's a great.
Who's organizing that?
Well, the one organization I thought would be out in front of this would be the U.S. Chamber. And we've heard nothing out of the U.S. Chamber.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, Bob?
Well, not if you want to avoid a real disaster, which would hurt business as much as anybody would hurt. I mean, if we have a default, and the financial institutions of this country are going to be in serious trouble, which means that industry is going to have a hard time getting some money if they haven't got it in their pocket already. It's going to be a disaster for everybody.
Let's look at Geithner for a second. I mean, the word on the street is that Geithner's gone within a little bit. I mean, they're talking about Michael Bloomberg being possible Secretary of Treasury. They're talking about getting Warren Buffett out of Berkshire Hathaway. They need a big time, full blown superstar rock star for finance. Is Timothy Geithner at this stage a lame duck Treasury Secretary?
He was good as Hank Paulson's number two.
We see
that a lot in life.
Yeah. Wow.
We see that a lot. Number two gets to number one. There's a lot more involved.
Now you just
said known as the Peter Principle, yeah. I think.
Thank you, my friend.
Wow.
Exactly,
yeah.
You see, Dustin, you said something very interesting a moment ago. We were just talking about does he have credibility. And you named two people, Michael Bloomberg and Warren Buffett, who the public know what they're doing when they talk finance. So if they would say something, but 99% of the people in this country today can't tell you who the Treasury Secretary is, and he's in the papers
because,
every day.
Because, yeah, but let's be honest.
I understand.
Was the last time?
Yeah, I understand what
you're
saying.
You have to go back to Alexander Hamilton before somebody can start really talking about a Treasury Secretary.
No, you don't. You could listen. When Alan Greenspan was head of the Fed, he spoke.
Not Treasury Secretary. That
no,
wasn't what you said.
No, but we're talking about a financial guy. Financial guy. The point is, Geithner doesn't.
Let's go back that far. Jim Baker.
No. Yeah, Jim Baker was tough.
Yeah,
good.
Jim Baker was tough.
There's a lot of good people. The point is, what we're saying is, if we had a Bloomberg or a Buffett, who the public knows and has heard for years is really financial gurus and geniuses, if they were saying this is so serious, we have no choice but to do it. Today,
but
there'd be a different view among the general public that, gee, maybe I do have to accept a little tax increase. Gee, maybe I will have to have, a little bit less in some benefits, but I can deal with it.
Yeah, but Al, if the president at this point, they somehow come up, even with a Band-Aid deal, and they have to replace Treasury Secretary Geithner, you put somebody like Bloomberg or you put somebody like Warren Buffett in place, is that going to look like just a Las Vegas show deal?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that this president is feeling his way around his appointees. He, for example, made a good replacement for Gates, who was a good defense secretary. Leon Panetta. Now, I think he may be making better choices on his second round than he made in his first round, which could indicate that he's learned something.
Yeah.
One would hope.
Cheers for that.
That is a good point. That is a very good point.
Yeah, and I think you
could. It's hard to change people in the middle of a crisis.
Yeah, but at some point though, you have to start looking. At what point do I cut fish, or what point do I cut bait and say, hey, I'm at a point of no return. I gotta get somebody in here. To me, somebody like Warren Buffett who doesn't have government experience, that's too commercial for me. Somebody like Bloomberg, perhaps. I think Bloomberg would be a good choice.
All respect to all of our advancing ages, I don't think Buffett's the guy for this job
now.
No,
he's too old.
I think he's not.
Bloomberg's brilliant.
Yeah,
Bloomberg would be an interesting choice. Look at what he's done in New York City.
Although
broadcasting from a cigar bar in Washington D.C.
Got another thought for you.
What's that?
Dominic Strauss-Kahn may be available.
No, actually, he's got another problem. We were going to talk about that today. I got word today. He's got another problem on the front.
Oh,
he's got a possible.
But that's in France. This is over here.
The whole extradition.
However, we were earlier of jobs open in attorneys' offices. I think that the guy that's really got the hot seat is Cyrus Mayer. He was supposed to be the savior coming in. He was going to be the guy that finally replaced and had the stature of Morgenthau and. This one didn't go
We're coming up on the break right now, but we're going to continue to talk about this. But what I want to do is bring up something that we talked about earlier, John, is because this is leading right into, all the discussion we've heard. You've got to find new revenue, no question about it. We've got to find new ways to improve the tax code, no question about it. The one thing that we heard the president speak of last week, which he actually got caught in kind of a little pants on fire, a little lie, is that he is the first and only president to do a full comprehensive review on regulations governing business. Not so much there, boss. But it does beg the question, are we in fact regulating ourselves out of business? And I want to talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C., 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. And we're back here in Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. And yeah, just to let you know, John, Shelley's back room is pretty much sponsors us, so that's why we do the plugs every break. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue our discussion from the last segment about the whole fiscal crisis that's facing the Capitol, facing the Beltway, facing, well, just about everybody in America right now. But we want to talk about a little bit about a comment that the president made earlier this week about us not really being competitive when it comes to the regulatory environment. I've heard several people in the talking head circuit talk about that we can no longer be competitive in the world marketplace as far as manufacturing in particular because we are over-regulated. Al, you're just dying to chime in on this.
I think the two parties have both been irresponsible in this. The Democrats over-regulate and the Republicans under-regulate or give up regulation altogether. We remember during the savings and loan crisis under Ronald Reagan, essentially he appointed a guy who didn't believe in regulation, and so he went in and he stopped regulating. Bingo, you had a big crash. But Democrats always have constituencies out there that want to tie down every last little possibility that somebody might squeeze around the intent of Congress, and hence they write regulations that are very complex and very expensive to comply
very
with.
Very restrictive.
And require an enormous cost in reporting. So I think it's finding a balance. I personally believe that the free enterprise system is not a good system, but it's the best system. It's kind of like democracy, is politically. But if you allow unrestrained free enterprise, you will end up with monopoly. I mean, it might take 10 years or 1,000 years, but you're going to end up with one guy with all the chips. You've got to have regulation for that.
Well, let me throw a wrench into this for a second. And, you know, one man's monopoly is another man's government-subsidized industry. We are not competitive.
You mean like China?
No. How about this? Let's look at the shipbuilding industry. At one time, the American merchant marine shipbuilding industry was the largest in the world. And we built some of the greatest, most elaborate ships in the world. Yet, because of Italian subsidies going to Italian shipyards, Norwegian subsidies going to Norwegian,
right.
The biggest one is Korean. The Korean shipyards are pretty much wholly owned subsidiaries of Seoul. One man's monopoly is another man's government-subsidized industry. Where's the fine line in this? Where's the balance?
It doesn't seem to me that that's hard to find. It seems to me that what you need to do is get the intent of Congress in passing the legislation and do the basic regulation necessary to track that and not try to make it perfect. Making it perfect is when you get into a huge amount of effort to get a little measure of protection.
John, talk about the other part of this, not the financial, but health and safety part, which is, we call it the train wreck, and what's happened is an extraordinary confluence of major regulatory packages have been coming out of EPA at the same time, the utility rule, the boiler rule, and it's not orchestrated. I mean, it's too much, too soon, too quick on too many fronts. Nobody is watching the cumulative impact. The president said he's done a regulatory review. Well, I'm not sure that we've seen the outcome of that. We all want food safety. We all want clean air. We all want food
clean
safety
water.
Protection. Look at the latest thing coming out of Germany. You know, 238 people died there. One person died in Monterey when we had the same thing. But we want a strong presence, but nobody looks at the incremental layers and the cumulative impacts of these regulatory things. EPA and FDA are great at regulating. They know how to bulletproof their stuff.
But these are the people that also do the enforcement, too, which brings up a whole nother line.
I'm going right there.
There we go.
You go there. It's just, that's exactly right. So all of a sudden, you get the utility industry, which has a few bad actor plants, and just this mass of regulations descending on them, all under the guise of mercury. Well, we don't want mercury in the air. I don't want mercury in the air. You don't want mercury in the air. But it's just, it encompasses everything.
Yeah,
it's too much.
In this case, are we truly regulating ourselves out of business? If you ask the power utility, if you ask the power generation community, they'll sit there, all right, if it's not mercury, you know what? It's my NOx. I gotta spend $2 million on my NOx scrubbers because I got EPA regulating and enforcing the same thing, and there's no incumbency in enforcement. Because now you've got EPA that has to double dip into paying for states to enforce the Clean Air and Clean Water Act rules in their own jurisdictions. You've got all kinds of problems.
But
EPA is one of the great ones.
But the fact is, you've mentioned NOx, that's a gas turbine byproduct. We're going to much more gas because it's competitive. It's becoming competitive with coal. We know how to control NOx. NOx is no big deal. SO2 is no big deal. Sulfur dioxide.
Well, let's get back.
So I don't know that we need a lot of new layers. We need to have the stuff that we know how to do work better.
Well, let's go back to the central point of this. Is again, you know, are we regulating ourselves? You know, if I am not just on a tax base, because right now the tax code's got to be rewritten because we have the most cost prohibitive tax code for foreign investment to come into country for manufacturing or even technology development. We can't do it. So that's a given. But if I am, let's say I am Siemens, I want to create a biomedical manufacturing facility in upstate New York. I can't do that cost effectively because of the regulatory requirements that are involved, and I'm going to be regulated to whereas the cost of a plastic syringe that should be 5 cents to cost is now 25 cents. And I can't be competitive with a 2 cent syringe being made in Korea.
But one of the things about the free enterprise system is it tends to drag things down to the lowest common denominator. If one guy in an industry is cheating, he has a competitive advantage over everybody else in the field, and it tends to put pressure on others to cut corners as well. So you need some regulation to be sure that people are playing, I hate to use the cliche, but on a level playing
field. But Bob, at what point do we have to sit there and take a serious look at, we talk about the fiscal crisis, manufacturing jobs have seen a little bit of an uptick, but we are by no means manufacturing the way we did 20, 30 years ago because we have a subsidized global economy that we have to compete with. We have prohibitive regulations that we have to compete with on a global scale.
Well, I don't see where you're going. You said Bob, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
But I don't see where you're going. If people are doing bad things regularly against regulations, what? And you say we should remove the regulations? You're just going to live with the bad things? I don't.
I think it takes a streamline. I think it takes a practicality to it. I mean, we can be sensible about this. Having to fight. Go ahead, Bob.
No, I was going to say the same thing. All we have to do. I mean, there are so many different regulations going on, and different people regulating in the same areas. Everything overlaps, and pretty soon it's just too blank and much.
Right.
Well,
it seems to me the sense is to stop that.
Clean it up. It starts in Congress. I can remember, and this is about the Democrats. I remember we had a bill out of Energy and Commerce in which we were clamping down on a series, and I can't remember, something like 20, 30 chemicals. And this was something where local government was going to have the responsibility of doing local regulation of that. Some well-meaning Democrat offered an amendment that added 3,600 chemicals to that. And we said, there's not a city in the United States that is set up to even deal with 3,600 in 30. You know, and we managed to kill that. But there's this emphasis on the Democratic side of wanting to get every last little jot and tittle. Likewise, the Republicans say, you know, all regulations are bad, and that is not true. So finding the balance is something that we should be searching for, and in this Congress,
it's almost impossible. It is almost an impossible endeavor to try and find. You've got regulatory agencies. I hate to keep picking on EPA, but EPA seems to be the problem child in many instances. you've got EPA that has got their own fiefdom. They're not going to give up that regulatory and enforcement capacity doing what they do,
even though it overlaps
a lot with everybody. They've got regulations that overlap with OSHA, overlap with Coast Guard, overlap with even state jurisdictions in many instances.
Well, yeah, it's a 3D movie, and your Siemens guy is going to be dealing with the state bureaucracy, he's going to be dealing with the local bureaucracy, probably a county, probably three or four federal agencies, like OSHA's in the Department of Labor. If there's any safety issues, it's in HHS and EPA.
Right.
He shouldn't have to do that. He should be able to say, what is the complex of regulations? What these guys want is certainty and a budget. Want to know how much is it going to cost me to put a plant in Lake Oswego, New York?
Right.
And what do I have to do?
Right.
They ought to be able to get that.
But they can't get that now, and that seems to be a problem. And that's still
only Congress can do this.
But yet Congress seems to be, at least at this stage, back to a regulatory, we go back to the vicious circle of we've got a regulatory environment that is too restrictive in developing new business, and then we've got a legal system that actually encourages frivolous lawsuits. We've become a litigious society. One feeds into the other. At what point do we put a stopgap and say, all right, wait a minute, this ends now? Do we do it through committeeship? Do we do it through the House? Or do we get a judiciary that says, hey, you know what, I'm going to start dropping the hammer on this?
Well, and how do you do that?
Yeah. What you need to do is you need the Congress to decide that tort reform is necessary. And it's very hard for the members of the Congress who are friends with the tort bar, the litigation bar, to say to the litigation bar, you know, we're going to change at least some of the rules.
Yeah.
And they're not—they're uncomfortable doing that. You know, and that's a fact. Now, the only way to overcome that is to decide that we need a better system. We need a system that penalizes those who need to be penalized, but the frivolous issues are put aside and said you can't do that. Now, you know, that's hard to do because you're talking a lot of campaign contributions, a lot of political support, and people naturally don't want to, you know, dump on their friends.
But, I mean, but the frivolous lawsuits tie into the restrictive regulations that make companies hesitant to do business here in the U.S., which takes away from taxes, from generating tax revenue, which takes away from creating revenue to fix the delta in the deficit.
I don't know how to do this either, but what is really the core of this problem in both issues is that more is decided in terms of ideology than it is in terms of logic.
Practicality.
Yeah.
In practicality.
Yeah.
And I think ideology is a good thing in the sense that it gives you a general direction in which you're trying to move public policy. When you start saying my ideology is the perfect ideology in every instance, then you end up with extremes and you get nothing done.
When ideology trumps common sense,
right,
you're off base. And we have that all the time.
Going from 30 chemicals to 3,600 chemicals. Yeah.
Well, we're at the top of the hour. We're going to take a quick 2-minute break. When we come back, we're going to continue this discussion. We're digging down another sidebar and look at the debt ceiling issue. How truly important, what is the right message that needs to get out to the general electorate about the debt ceiling? We're going to talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back.
What did you say we were going to talk about?
We're talking about the debt ceiling issue. What is the right message that needs to get out to the general electorate about how important this is and how do we come up with a message that's everyday life? What is the right message that got to get out to everybody and say, well, you've got to get up on
the president just said it in his speech. No.
I guess Jack, let's have that still. Okay, go check.
Just you and I.
This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We're having to put out a little bit of a discussion here from the Peanut Gallery, me and my friend.
It's a My Little Pony moment.
Yeah, no kidding. Anyway, we're back for the first hour, or for the final hour of Backroom Politics here from Shelley's Backroom. Joining me, as always, every Tuesday is Congressman Al Swift to my left.
Yo.
To my right, he is the Honorable Bob Hines. Joining us in the seat that usually occupies Bob Hines, because Bob is occupying the seat that usually goes to Dr. Ralph Whitty, is our special guest today, John
Freshman.
Talk about
over-regulation.
Yeah,
that is over-regulated.
That is over-regulated. Damn it, I'm government-subsidized, too. Anyway, let's talk about the debt ceiling crisis, because that time clock still ticks. I think we've kind of gone into a larger view of the fiscal crisis, but I think the debt crisis is going to be an issue. And by the way, thank you very much, Maddie. It's happy hour now at Backroom Politics. Al's got his martini. I'm feeling under the weather, so I'm having a Jack Daniel's neat vodka tonic. Everybody's going around for happy hour. When we talk about the debt ceiling, and I want to open this up to the table and find out, can anybody truly talk about, just in 100,000-foot level overview, why, again, the debt ceiling is important? You want to try this one out, or give it to Bob, or John, you're welcome to join in.
Oh, man, Bob, you are usually pretty good at things like that.
Well, the problem is that the United States does not live on an island. You know, a whole lot of other things impact this as well. Keep that in mind as a background. But from the standpoint of our own little part of the world, the debt, if we do not have the money to pay our bills as of the 3rd of August, the United States government has to decide what expenditures they're going to make and which ones they defer. They don't pay. If they do that, they have to start making choices. And they're going to make choices that are going to give them enough money to pay those things which they think are absolutely necessary. Now, probably Social Security is absolutely necessary. Medicare.
You're talking about defaulting on the bills we owe.
Exactly. And so obviously we're going to be paying a lot of the things we absolutely positively have got to pay, like Medicaid and Social Security. But there are an awful lot of things the United States does that are equally important and vital, and we have to be able to pay our bills.
Al, go ahead.
I've always liked the analogy of the debt ceiling and your credit card bills.
Yeah.
You've already spent the money.
Yeah.
You've spent the money. You should have made that decision a long time ago.
Yeah. And
because what you're really saying, if you say I'm not going to raise the debt ceiling, you're saying I'm not going to pay my credit card bill.
Right.
Yeah. And go ahead.
And that analogy with the credit card is something that every American ought to be able to understand.
And a long time ago, we as a nation, through our Congress, with our administrations, various parties over the years, have made decisions about what we're going to spend money on and how much we're going to spend. But we haven't funded ourselves sufficiently. We haven't raised enough revenues to cover the things we've already bought,
and we're fighting two wars off the budget.
Yeah.
Well, we still got to pay for them, but they're not.
And so we churn money out and we issue bonds, and people buy bonds all over the world. We've got those bonds come due, and interest on the bonds comes due. We have to make those payments to people.
John, you look like you kind of cringed a little bit at that description.
Well, I'm just going to say I love Al's analogy, and when you finally end up paying those credit card bills, they're not cheaper. So when we finally pay the debts that we are going to continue to incur if we don't do the debt ceiling, it's going to cost us, you, me, more money.
Well,
more money. The numbers are there.
Well, you know, we talk about the credit cards. We talk about the credit card. We talk about, you know, the technical aspects of the debt ceiling. When we look at this, and we look at how this all comes about, the bottom line here is that there's got to be a message that goes out to the American public that they can relate to. The simplest one seems to be your argument about the credit cards scenario. Why is it so difficult for the White House or the Treasury Department or even Congress to put this into terms that could be easily sold to a general electorate if they wanted to?
No guts.
Really?
No guts.
Why?
Because the public doesn't understand this issue in large measure because nobody explains it to them. And rather, the members of Congress are going home to their districts and explaining, using the credit card analogy or a more lucid and technical one, instead of doing that, they go home and cower and say, well, I voted against raising it. Because people then think you've stopped spending money. You already spent the money.
Yeah. All you're doing is saying that we're just not going to pay the bill.
That's right.
Take as an example, we have talked in the past about the most valuable asset a president has, and that is the bully pulpit.
Right.
When he speaks, the country pays attention. That's the general rule. It's been a general rule since presidents have spoken. The fact of the matter is, if the president would go on television, if he had in his last press conference, if somebody had asked him, you know, why it's important, if he would have used the credit card analogy, how clear that would have been to a lot of people who, when you talk about...
He does get a little professorial.
Yeah, when you talk about the reality of the universal, you know, interconnection of the financial world, it's difficult for the public to understand that, and they tune out. And that's the reason people don't say it. It's much easier to say, if you bought something on a credit card, the bill is going to come due, and you have to pay it.
While we've been on the air, the president, apparently, we don't know what he said, the president apparently said something on this general topic, and it will be very interesting to know what it is.
Well, we're going to check as we talk right now over with our friends at Politico, www.politico.com, just to give them a shout-out, because they are very supportive of backroom politics, at least we hope they are. We're going to get an idea of what... the president was talking about. It looks like that he has come out and said that he is in fact going to host deficit talks at the White House again. He is pretty much showing out. And Bob, this goes back to it's about damn time. Frank, put your hand up for a little bit. What do you got?
Question, and I want input from everybody. We all talk about the need to deficit reduction, and the default, which would be bad for everybody. What would be the ramifications of taking the trillions of subsidies that we give to other countries, $5 billion here, $10 billion here, to all these companies that probably aren't going to pay it back anyway? If we took 1 year...
You're talking about countries or companies?
Countries. Like the $10 billion we give to China. Not on something that we owe, but in a subsidy that... money that we just feel that they need. What would be the ramifications if we said for 1 year, no?
Well, if you're talking about foreign aid,
right?
It is not that big a percentage of the
no,
budget.
It's a very small piece.
So would it carry 1%? Us into
no.
where?
Okay,
no.
Thank, no.
No.
Right. And we can't.
It's not
we can't.
There.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that.
Remember that the bulk of that money goes to Egypt and Pakistan.
Yeah.
So you know where the lion's share
well,
in Israel.
Well, I was going to say, you've got Israel in the mix.
I should have said Israel.
You've got Israel in the mix. I mean,
Egypt, and Pakistan is where most of that money goes.
Well, you still got also, you know, some of the developing countries in the African Horn. I mean, you know, when we talk about foreign aid, don't forget, we're still talking about USAID, USTDA money.
No.
You know, a lot of that is still investing in, for example, the African side of the house, but... I don't think, go back to Frank's, I don't think it's enough to have such an impact on it.
From a citizen's point of view,
it's a good question.
Very much so.
No, you want to say, well, what are we willing to cut?
One thing we haven't talked about in the context of this dust up over the debt ceiling is that there's another game at play here, which is presidential politics.
Well, yes, that's
and,
very
and,
true.
And, you know, it's a subtext in the whole thing. And what this president, you know, he's got his eye on an event that's going to happen in 16 months. And
and the Republicans have their eye on this, and there are a lot of people that think that if the president can't get anything done, if nothing happens, then we're going to vote in a Republican, and then we can make the big changes that we want. Not arguing for it. I'm just saying there's a lot of presidential politics.
Oh, absolutely. But we've also had this argument, and Bob, Al, and I have all discussed it. You know, we don't see the type of leadership coming out of the White House right now that needs to be demonstrated in a time such as this. You know, we look at David Cameron in the UK. We look at Stephen Harper in Canada. All have come out and made really tough decisions, possibly at the cost of their own political careers. And they've come out, and they're coming out stronger. They're coming out more. They're coming out more fluid. They're coming out more streamlined. But they're making some tough decisions. Something we have not seen here in the U.S. in today's political circles, because everybody's too worried about running for office again. I think what we've done is the fact that we're starting presidential primary talk a year and a half, 18, almost 24 months out, takes away from the president's ability to go out there and lead.
No question.
You know, if you want to talk about reform, we could do a whole best of show that we'll pre-record on changing the federal elections.
Yeah,
that's all. But I don't want to get into that because that's going to convolute everything.
Yeah, but what I was going to suggest is we have all been, and I have been, critical of the president for not giving more leadership. But let's not overlook the Republicans. John Boehner has got a miserable hand he's trying to play. I mean, he's got the Tea Party people, which I know John Boehner. He's conservative, absolutely, but he is not. He's not the kind of mindless ideologue that the Tea Party people
are.
He's
civil. They're not mindless. They're just ideologues.
Well, I think, okay.
Be civil.
It's very hard. I was going to change it and it was going to be even worse. So
Don't do that.
But he has got a part of his party that does not allow him the freedom to do the kinds of things that I think he would be doing. I remind you again, this is the guy that worked with Teddy Kennedy and George Miller, one of the most liberal members of the House, and got an education bill through the Congress. So he's demonstrated an ability to work across the aisle in a rational way and get things done. He hasn't got the freedom to do that. Now, with regard to Mitch McConnell in the Senate, I truly don't understand the man. I mean, when you begin in saying the primary purpose that I have for the next 2 years is to defeat the President of the United States, it isn't suggesting that he wants to be very helpful.
No, I agree with that. But I also agree with the fact that it is difficult for... Look, we said early on that John Boehner could be one of those powerful speakers to come out since Tip. Unfortunately, the hindrance on that is Eric Cantor and the Tea Party. You've got people like Eric Cantor. You've got Michelle Bachmann, who is now too busy running for president to be too much of a pain in the side of Speaker Boehner.
A quick, interesting aside, we got two people from Minnesota running for president, and the state is shut down.
Good. Wow. Spoken like a true Democrat, too. Nicely done, John.
It happened to be Republican.
I was going
to
say, nicely done. Way to throw that spear out there. Oh, God.
Well,
so what are you giving a thumbs up for? Don't encourage that.
No, why not?
Oh,
I like
good
it.
Lord. But when we talk about
truth, truth is okay here.
Yeah, I mean, you literally can't make this stuff up.
No.
You really can't talk about this stuff.
Well.
You've got two, to really talk about it for a sidebar real quick, you've got two people running for president of the Republican Party saying, hey, I got an idea. We're going to talk about fiscal responsibility. And meanwhile, the government shut down. Now then. It is under a Democratic governor. Let's be real.
Oh, yeah. That's fine.
Okay.
Mark Dayton's his name.
Yeah. There is a Democratic governor. Didn't want to throw stones at that one too much, but there is a Democratic governor. Well, but it is a Republican-led legislature, too.
Yeah.
So there's plenty to go all around on that one. But when we look at, you know, John Boehner having the ability to truly show the leadership he needs to and truly stand up and get the right message out, having to check himself with Eric Cantor and the rest of those behind the Tea Party line has got to take away his ability to be effective in showing leadership.
It's like taking a racehorse and putting hobbles on them, and then expect it to win the race.
Won't happen. Well, but you know, it's
a little bit why you see Boehner and Obama hanging back.
Yeah. You think so?
Absolutely, I think so.
How so?
Well, Boehner has not been doing the Biden meetings. Obama has not been doing the Biden meetings. Both of them were trying to control their respective caucuses, splinter groups, members of their party, ideological subgroups. Sure.
Well, I mean, let's be real. I mean, you don't have the handcuff that the president doesn't have the handcuff that John Boehner has when it comes to being able to effectively lead his party in the role he's given. You don't have the splintered Democratic Party the way we do in the GOP.
I respectfully think there's another view, which is sooner or later the liberals who ran the roost for 2 years are going to reach their breaking point, because all of this stuff that we call fiscal responsibility and reform and entitlement reform goes right to the heart of the Democrats' special interest groups, right to the heart of them.
Absolutely.
Well, the president...
And he needs them to get reelected. That's one.
That brings up a whole interesting point. But going back to what the president said, breaking news coming out of Politico. According to Politico, President Obama said Congress should not, quote, unquote, kick the can down the road on a short-term debt limit increase, and said that he has asked congressional leaders to come to the White House on Thursday and drive towards a final agreement. I got to tell you something. That's a big belly up to the bar.
It's the first time he said that in 6 months. I'm glad he said it.
Does he have enough credibility now, coming late to the game in leadership?
He is the president.
Can he get everybody and close the door and keep them there? Something that Biden could not.
You can't get everybody in the door for anything except for a pay raise. Outside of that, you can't. But you
can't get everybody inside the door for a pay raise. I swear.
You want a bigger one? Is that it?
There would be at least three votes against a resolution welcoming the dawn.
Yeah.
You know,
That's true.
But the fact of the matter, the fact that the president has obviously been taking counsel with some of the leaders privately and quietly, probably on both sides, I'm all but sure. I can't believe he has it.
I think what he's
finally realized is, I think he's maybe he's seen.
What is driven him to do this?
Let me finish. I think he may have seen some information polling that indicates the public is beginning to realize that it really is a serious problem. He may be saying to himself, now it's a chance. Now I'm going to go for it.
But why not? What drove him to this?
Well, he's only got 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, there's been one major change in the White House.
The chief of staff.
You think Daley's doing something that Rahm Emanuel couldn't do? We got John saying two
major changes.
What's
head
that?
Of OMB, Jack Lew, as respected a man in Washington. He's like Rob Portman, who had the same job.
Right.
You can't find anybody that doesn't trust him and doesn't believe him on either party or either side. Rob Portman was the same way. Now he's a senator. Jack Lew came in and took over OMB.
Yep.
You better believe he's a numbers guy. He's not the spokesman we were talking about earlier.
Right.
But he is the numbers guy that everybody believes.
Everybody
on both sides.
Does the loss of Austin Goolsbee play into this at all?
Not in my mind.
Only because he was close to the president. The fact that he is, whatever he would say to the president would pay a lot of attention to. But, I mean, I think John's exactly right. You've got two people, you're both right. You've got two people in the White House who really are serious players, and I think they're helping the president to understand how serious it is. And if the president does, and I think he does, the fact that he wants the leadership to arrive at the White House in a couple of days is very good news, because it's the first time the president has said, I want everybody who can make the decisions to be in the room with me, and I want them in on this week.
This reinforces what I said about he seems to be making better choices the second time
around
than he did the first time around.
With the selection of
Law and Daley.
Daley.
And why things were the way they were when Rob Emanuel was there is inexplicable to me, because Rahm Emanuel is a very tough, savvy guy, but it wasn't happening. You know, but we don't know the exact relationship between him and the presidents.
Well, there were an awful lot of independent thinkers and people who thought they were the smartest people in the world in the White House when I first started. You know, people like Larry Summers and others.
Exactly.
And there were people who, you know, just were thinking about what they wanted to think about rather than what the president's called. I think they've got a better team now because of those two guys.
What they're missing is the outfront economic tax spokesman.
Yeah.
That's the only piece that that we discussed earlier.
Right.
That we all agree.
Well, presidents burn a hell of a lot in their first 2 years. I think with the exception of Ronald Reagan, and the reason there was probably Baker, it's hard to find a president whose first 2 years weren't rocky as hell. Richard Nixon, who was supposed to be, you know...
Textbook in his first term was 43.
And he was terrible.
Right.
Yeah.
43.
And Bill Clinton really didn't get off the ground until after his first term.
Can the president strike a deal even with the restrictions that the Tea Party places on everything? Bob?
It's the best chance we have that everybody is in the room with the president, and the president has called the leadership in. He's made a statement about it. The public is going to hear that, and they're going to think, gee whiz, this really might be a crisis. Maybe I should start worrying about it a little bit and listen to people who are saying it's a crisis, and that's going to help the guys and gals going back home to be able to say, this is a serious crisis.
But John, then it goes back to what you all were talking about earlier, and I think it's great progress too, but Boehner, among others, is, as anybody would be, is a great student of Tip O'Neill. Tip O'Neill was quoted by Denny Hastert frequently, and the answer is you have to have a majority of the majority. You cannot create a coalition of Republicans and Democrats and get this through.
No.
They got to get a majority of the majority.
Yep.
And so once it goes back up there, I think Boehner has as good a chance of pulling. I wouldn't want to try to do it. It's a hard job. Has as good a chance of pulling that off as anybody. But he's got to get a majority of the majority. He can't take enough Democrats and, you know, half the Republicans to get this over the top. The political effects of that are catastrophic.
Right.
That's a good point, and it's a true one.
Yep. Al, do you think the president can pull this off and get everybody with the restrictions the Tea Party's got on the part on the Republicans?
I think he can. That's not saying he will, but he can.
This is the best chance we're going to have.
This news conference today, or the statement today, is the second time he has come out and given a leadership position. And I think that if that's a trend, as it looks like it might be, then I think he can do it.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about presidential politics. There is new talk right now about Biden being replaced. Not a big fan of that, because I love Joe Biden as our vice president. But there's talk about replacing Biden on the ticket. We're going to talk about Newt's really bad second quarter report. And we're going to talk about the rest of the presidential politics going on inside the Beltway. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Thank you. We're back here at Chili's Back Room live for our final half hour on Backroom Politics, live from Chili's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to talk a little bit, switch gears, and talk about the presidential race going on, the lack of racing by some of the candidates, and some new rumors coming out of the Democratic ticket. Let's start with the Democratic ticket. The rumor going around today is that certain DNC officials were talking to Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, to be a possible running mate for Obama's second term run.
They should be fired.
Well, here's the quote. Is Andrew Cuomo's quote is, "I will not, or I won't replace Joe Biden," quote unquote. His comment is, "This is just political chatter and silliness." He made those comments in Buffalo yesterday, and it was based off of a New York Post column on Monday that cited some DNC sources. Does it make sense for President Obama to at least consider the possibility of taking Joe Biden out and putting in somebody a little bit younger? Al?
Younger?
I'm sorry, relatively speaking, I apologize.
You're an ageist.
Yes. Al and I take great offense.
So I forgot you were old enough to babysit Joe Biden at one time. I apologize.
I think it makes utterly no sense to be considering replacing him because he has been a very good vice president. Furthermore, it seems to me the president would never have put him in charge of dealing with this economic problem as he has if he didn't have enormous confidence in it. And there's no reason why he shouldn't have.
No, absolutely not. Go ahead.
From Cuomo's point of view, he clearly would like to be president someday. He's a rising star. He's just solved his budget problem. He's on a roll up there. There's no chance that he would view this as anything other but a step backward from what his ultimate ambition is. I haven't talked to him about his ambition, but he's young, he's Cuomo, he's governor of a huge state.
He's got the family legacy behind him. Wouldn't do him no good to do this.
Look at it from his point of view.
It's odd enough that he's almost in the same position as his neighbor to the west in New Jersey, is Chris Christie. Now's not his time. Chris Christie says, now is not my time. Excuse me. We haven't figured out a cough mute button yet. I apologize for that.
I feel ill. I'm coming down with something. I think I may have caught it from you.
You know what? You can talk to my attorney and you can sue me. Talk about tort reform. Reform this. Reform this. So when we talk about Andrew Cuomo, you got to look at him and say, hey, wait a minute. Now's not his time. The almost identical situation that you have with Chris Christie in New Jersey, governor of a high visibility, high populous state, powerful up-and-coming rise in the party. The only difference is Chris Christie doesn't have the backing of the family legacy of Mario Cuomo that Andrew Cuomo does.
But what he's doing is balancing the budget in the state.
Things done. No, he's got some baggage. Make no mistake about it. Andrew Cuomo's got a lot of baggage. He's got a lot of baggage that he's bringing to the
party. What he just said isn't baggage, though.
I'm not saying that.
It's good precursor to
No, it is. It absolutely is. But make no mistakes about it. Just as Chris Christie's got baggage, just as Rick Perry has baggage, Andrew Cuomo's got baggage. He's going to have to bring alongside.
Everybody's got baggage. It's all checked outside.
Yeah, unfortunately. But this brings up a good point, though. When we hear about this every year. We heard this with Bill Clinton. We heard this with Bill Clinton when he was running for his second term that. He, in fact, was going to look at a replacement for Al Gore, somebody who was a little bit more dynamic, somebody that could take a little bit of the heat off of him being just Bill Clinton. There was always talk about that. There was talk about George Bush replacing Cheney in his second run, which turned out to be not correct, just political chatter. We're going through this every year. Yep. Is this just almost a reality check, or is this something that really needs to happen just to keep balance in the universe? Bob?
Let me answer a different question.
Okay.
Isn't Debbie Wasserman the chairman of the
DNC? Yes.
Now, here's somebody who is certainly in tune with the president. Why is her organization, if it is the group that's leaking stuff, how in the hell does that happen? I mean, I understand there are always some loose cannons around, but it's, you know, it just makes no damn sense at all to have staff of the DNC, if that's where it leaked from, to have some to have talking about this. It's a dumb idea from the president's standpoint. It's a dumb idea from the governor's standpoint.
And it could be a plant.
It could be. It could be very well. I mean, we also got to consider the source. I mean, it is the New York Post.
Maybe Newt Gingrich started it.
Well, I you mentioned that there was rumors about Al Gore. I happened to be in a meeting with President Clinton, a very informal meeting, and they were talking about some environment, doing some things that would make me going to ruffle the feathers of the environment. And Clinton said, "We'll let Al take care of that." He obviously relied on him and saw him as a useful person.
Well, I think there's a difference between Al Gore and the relationship he had with Bill Clinton than there is with Obama and Biden. I think Obama realizes, hey, I'm still relatively new to this game. Biden brings him a certain level
foreign
of
policy.
Not just foreign policy. It brings him, and not even the Senate. I think it's more broad than that. I think he brings him a certain level of Washington credibility that he did not necessarily have. And that's key. I don't think Andrew Cuomo could give the same old sage Yoda counsel that
it's
Joe
not
Biden
as if
does.
New York is a swing state. That you need to reinforce.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz actually makes more sense than Andrew Cuomo does, because she can deliver at least in the southeast part of the state.
If New York becomes a swing state, it doesn't make any difference who the
president is. No, absolutely not. But when we look at this now, we also have to take a look at what's happening on the Republican side. Now, Politico is reporting the fact that Newt Gingrich had an absolute god-awful second quarter report. They call it, quote-unquote, grim. But he Newt Gingrich painted a grim picture of himself with the LA Times yesterday. He said, quote, "The fact is, a month of media barrage is painful, and it slowed a lot of things down. Before marching in on a 4th of July parade in Clear Lake, Iowa, our numbers will not be as good as we would like, and candidly, the consultants left us in debt. But every single week since they've left, we've been cutting down the debt, and we raise more money than we spend in a week."
Your consultants the same as Calista?
Depends on who you talk to. If you talk to one of the 14 staffers, then Calista equals not. Tiffany's apparently equals consultant now. But we won't go there. The reality is, though, is he really just spitting in the wind at this point? I mean, he's got to at some point realize this is a fruitless effort. He cannot possibly win.
He can't take votes away from the other two powerhouses, like Bachman. Bachman is going to rise up, but I don't think it's like a spoiler like Perot. Perot went in and spoiled it. Took the votes away from the Democratic side.
But what we got, let's look at Newt, though. Newt has got to understand that the time is clicking on him having to pull out of the race at some point. And Bob?
Well, what you just said, quoting Gingrich, sounds to me like Gingrich is fully aware of his chances, which are slim and none, and Swim is leaving the room. I don't think he has a chance in hell, and I think he understands it.
Do you think that?
I think he's basically, you know, in a nice way, saying, "I recognize it's a problem." If his positive statement is, "I'm bringing more money in than we're spending," and he doesn't have any staff, he doesn't need any money, so he's probably not getting any money in.
Does Newt Gingrich survive the month?
No.
You don't think so? You think that
it may be one of my hopeful wishes, but I don't think he does.
I think the worst thing in the world to a guy like him is happening, which is he's irrelevant. And all the things he doesn't want to be in his life, it's irrelevant. He's irrelevant.
Nobody, at least inside the Newt Gingrich camp, would have ever anticipated the fact that he would go into Iowa being in seventh place. Newt Gingrich's relevancy, I think he was pushed up a little bit by Fox News. Fox News gave him a false sense of credibility in a world that said, well, he's a good talking head. I just don't know I want this guy president. But we'll see how that plays out. But the other Republican that's apparently having a little bit of trouble is Herman Cain, the businessman out of Michigan, owner of Godfather's Pizza, who actually had, until recently, some good buzz about him. Getting some good Tea Party. He's very, very energetic. Does a great, great speech.
Did well in the
Iowa straw polls. But apparently, in Iowa, Charlie Grushow has left the Herman Cain camp, which is a huge blow because he's one of the big Tea Party supporters in Iowa. Bob?
I think probably a bunch of his votes went to Bachman.
Yep.
She's really doing well in Iowa. I think that's where the votes went there, and I don't think it's so much of, you know, gee, I was wrong about Mr. Cain. It's just that, boy, she has a better chance of winning, and I'm going to go with the winner. That's what I would think, because I know that's where the votes had to come from.
But along with losing his Iowa team, when she had two resignations, his top two people in Iowa has since resigned, but his New Hampshire state boss has also resigned, which gives you, you take out Iowa, you take out New Hampshire, you got a problem. Al, am I reading too much into that?
No, but Herman Cain was was not credible from the beginning. And part of that may have been because he was black.
Really?
Come on. This country hasn't moved that far. I think that was one. But mostly, nobody had ever heard of it. He'd never been active, in any way. He's never held public office before, and I think it was an intriguing entry, and he got a lot of focus because it was an intriguing entry, but I think it was one that was bound to disappear.
Yeah, well, you know, and he did well in the that one debate.
He did well in the
and
debate,
that boosted
yes.
Him,
absolutely.
Yeah, but the point was, she did better. She did better, and she is a Tea Party person to her heels, and I'm not sure he's quite as much a Tea Party, but certainly she's one of the really leaders of the National Tea Party organization, which he was not, and you've got to believe that they were much more happy being with her.
Well, one of the things we have to look at is the fact that, you know, let's look at what Grushow said when he left, is he's disappointed in some of the decisions that were made and some of the comments that were made by others, quote-unquote, and he said that the campaign had just become, quote-unquote, just too messy. That sounds like a campaign in disarray, at least in my political background.
Yeah.
That does not bode well, particularly in Iowa, for the Herman Cain camp. Does Herman Cain, who pulls out first, Herman Cain or Newt Gingrich?
I would think Newt, because he's got more to protect by getting out, and rather than being less humiliated, I don't think Herman Cain cares.
Okay, go ahead, Ralph. All right, go ahead, Frank.
I know, hold Al up. I agree with him. The problem I have with McCain is when he spoke eloquent and he had
Herman Cain.
When he spoke and he was asked this pointed question, well, what's going to happen about this situation? Well, when I get into office, I don't know about that situation, but when I get into office, I'll have advisors. You got to have the answers going in, not, I'm going to wait till I get in office, then I'll deal.
Yeah.
That's what bothered me about him.
Let's not have any honesty.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we look at Herman Cain, though, Herman Cain himself has just got an organizational problem that he's going to have to fix. I don't think that's going to be fixable at this stage in the game. I think we'll probably see him drop and then Newt Gingrich probably
out. It's a natural thinning, but I think the next guy you're going to hear dire things about is Pawlenty. Where do you think that Michelle's rise is coming from?
Yeah, Tim Pawlenty, I think Tim Pawlenty, we're hearing buzz already that Tim Pawlenty's having a little bit of backlash.
He's too nice.
That's what you're going to hear about him.
Really?
He doesn't have that killer instinct.
Really, I think Tim Pawlenty, we're already starting to hear some issues about. We're starting to hear some movement upward, though, in Huntsman. I just this week heard that Huntsman's starting to get a lot more of the business backing that would normally go to somebody like Mitt Romney. which is good news for Huntsman, but bad news for the Romney camp, who according to all sources is going to have a bang up second quarter as far as money raised.
Would a Romney Bachman ticket impress you?
No.
No.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Why?
Romney Bachman would create too much of a divisive. Too much of a divisive executive office. I don't think it works. I don't think he would pick her, and I don't think she would run as vice president on a Romney ticket.
They
disagree. But I think you got your finger on something. You know, Huntsman is an incredibly attractive guy.
He is.
He's smart. He's thoughtful. He's been a governor. He's a good guy.
Okay.
He's from a great family.
Okay, Bob. Okay, let's do this without increasing Bob's ego in this one. I only got 12 minutes to deflate his ego now, John.
I've been saying this for about, a couple of months?
Yes, you have.
Yes.
No, but you bring up a very good point. He has the CD, at least. He's got credibility in foreign policy, which you pointed out many times, Bob. He's got credibility on financial issues, which you point out his terms as governor and even his terms in business. He's got...
I will.
Wow. And the love fest continues here at Chili's Mac Road. Al, tell me a story.
I was thinking of this before we said so many good things about Huntsman. I think if I were President Obama, I would be more worried about him being my opponent than any of the other in the Republican field.
Really?
I think that everything we said about his weaknesses currently are true. He would have to overcome those. But if I were Obama, I'd say keep an eye on this guy because he could just possibly come through. And the most important thing, he could be the toughest opponent that I could have.
Okay, interesting. I have a tell me a story. I know it's shocking to everybody.
Tell
I actually keep an eye on Marco Rubio. The word is that Marco Rubio is being considered by several camps in the Republican ticket as being the VP selection. New Young can deliver Florida, still has a lot of respectability down there. Keep Marco Rubio. I would venture to say the word I've heard is Huntsman has already talked about it. Romney, if he hasn't approached it, is talking about it at some point coming up. And they're not the only one. Bachman is looking at him very closely. There's a strong Tea Party alliance there. Keep your eye on Marco Rubio, too. No matter who the VP, no matter who the presidential nominee is, he's going to be number two.
And he's not up for re-election.
And does not have to vacate the seat.
That's my point.
Exactly.
I have thought for some time that any Republican who has a chance to win has to pick Marco Rubio because he is just what we've all said.
I am reporting here right now that it is... I would give 50-50 odds on it right now. He will be the number two seat in any Republican
team. I think you're right.
Yeah.
And I think it should be.
Good call. I will make no bones about it. I knew Marco when he was a state legislator down in Tallahassee. Fantastic guy. Brilliantly smart. Very approachable. Very amicable guy. Can hold his own in just about any debate you bring up.
37, 38 years old?
He is, yes. He's 40. No, he's my age. He's 40 or 41. I know he, he's very close.
Like you.
He's my age. He's very, very politically astute. Very politically astute.
So we have decided that it's going to be
Huntsman Rubio.
Against Obama.
It'll be Huntsman, Romney, and Rubio will be in the number two seat.
You mean we have two guys running for president?
That's all I'll give you credit to. I mean, let's be honest. But we'll talk about that another time. Anything you need to pimp out?
Not at all.
Okay. John, by the way, thanks for joining us. I hope you had a good time
here. Had a great time. Anytime. Thanks for
John,
having me.
John, you're welcome anytime as a fellow Democrat. We've been saying we need more Democrats to support Al.
Love to.
Al gets beat up all the time. You're welcome here. Frank.
My pleasure.
my cigar, my Veritas cigar, has been doing very well.
Good.
This is the other sponsor.
We're going to start hitting up for money next week.
I will gladly dedicate a box of cigars to the group for a
sponsor. No. We're talking. You're getting airtime now. We're talking about you spending $250 a month to get us advertising.
Okay.
Yeah. Kind of cowboy up. We appreciate your support. Thank you very much, Frank. Al, anything on your front? Last closing minute.
No, I've been drained. I have no more ideas.
Wow, that's the first time you were speechless.
No, I didn't say that. It would not be the first time that I spoke without knowing anything about anything.
No, Al, don't give yourself that much credit. It's not the first time you've done that.
No, I said it's not the first time.
I thought you said it was the first time.
No. Listen carefully.
I can't. I'm congested. If you can't hear it, my God.
Well, I'll get an ear trumpet for you.
What?
I'll get an ear...
He's walked right into that door. That was great. And the Vaudeville Slapstick Comedy continues. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, travel safe. We'll see you next week. Our special guest, John Freeman, Frank the Bodyguard.